You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, Christ is risen. This lecture is being recorded on the Feast of Pascha, 2024, May 5th. This is the Orthodox Nationalist, and of course, I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. I hope everyone had a productive Lent and Holy Week. I tended mentally to be a week behind for some reason. I'm not entirely sure why, but, and in that spirit, of course, I, am asking for financial donations, as you see in the description of this, program, the different ways that you can donate. I desperately need it because, you know, especially what I'm going to do today and what I've been doing, is really, it comes down to Good Friday, that when you go against certain people, you're going to be in serious trouble. Losing Facebook, losing PayPal was a tremendous blow. So however you decide to donate, whether through Patreon or whatever, I would be more than appreciative. Anyway, tonight we're talking about something extremely foundational, namely Plato's doctrine of the forms. You can't get any more fundamental than this. You also can't get any more controversial than this. Plato's Phaedo, the Cratylus, the Republic, Gorgias, these were the first stirrings of what we are generally call Western philosophical culture on both sides of the European divide. And of course, very much like the New Testament, this was born in the Greek-speaking world. Now, I don't think that's an accident. St. Justin Martyr didn't think it was an accident. But we're talking about the fundamental constituents of creation. We're talking about the second person of the Trinity. We're talking about the exemplars of creation to be found in Logos. I've been a Platonist my entire life. When I first read The Republic, I was 17 or 18. I was never the same again, and I became a Christian and eventually Orthodox, to a great extent, on what I read in The Republic. Of course, Plato has many errors, but that's easily understood because he had no revelation. This was naked reason in a dying society. The fact that Socrates was murdered, although not by the same people that Christ was murdered, but they were murdered for roughly the same reason. And people like St. Justin Martyr have a tremendous respect for Greek philosophy prior to Christ. And Christ, of course, via Logos, solved the problems that Plato left behind. If you encounter something, any object that you see on a daily basis, it's not present in any defensible metaphysical manner to our senses. And we see an individual thing, that's really a composite. It's a creation of our own minds, as well as the forces and the energy that come together to create what we might call an individual object. So any observable, any sensate thing that is before us is immediately decomposed into particles of force, forces whose, as Solovyov would say, can be sensed. Of course, not the force itself, as someone who is both a nominalist and an empiricist, for example, can perceive something ordinary, like a tree, and this tree exists solely in his mind. My senses and my brain has made brown and green out of the elementary forces of the tree, the energies that are interpreted by my mind and yours as colors or textures. It is, and if you've read my article on Losky and realism, of course, means the acceptance of the doctrine of the forms in Plato's sense in one form or another. Calling an object a thing is arbitrary. Any object immediately observable in nature is a collection of God knows how many innumerable pulses of force and energy. In reality, many things rather than a single thing. So what has to be justified isn't the theory of forms, but individual reality that we come across every day. Empiricism takes the interpretations of the outside world as proof of its existence, but it can only be taken on faith or utility. So empiricism, nominalism really only know internal psychic states. It's not a form of knowledge. It's very superficial. And it's justified only by the most base utilitarianism. One ends up with the doctrine of the forms or the elementary forces undergirding everything that can't be seen, sensed, or heard in any way. Anything we observe must be reduced to that which cannot be observed in order to make sense out of them. The forms are immaterial, universal things. I argued in the past that they're also things of social significance, that they always point beyond themselves. They're found not just as human nature, but within human nature. We're not talking about forms as objects in any practical sense. They're foundations for objects. Political justice is bringing the different aspects of human nature together into a harmonious whole, that is to say, each person doing what they are called to do to make the society work. In fact, coming together is justice. When you talk about the form of something, you use a capital letter. The form is justice with a capital J, distinguished from any just act or just situation that you might see or read about. It's what they all have in common. I wrote a paper that was published in Aristocratia some years ago, on the connection between Plato's doctrine of the forms on the one hand and social functions in human nature and natural law on the other hand. The forms are in opposition to the practical world. Plato, in the Republic, Book 9, says that those rejecting the forms are busy with gluttony and sensuality. They move, as he says, randomly throughout life. They never pass into the upper world of knowledge. They taste not pure or abiding pleasure. Like cattle with their eyes always looking down, their heads stooping to the earth, to the dining table, they fatten and feed and breed, and their excessive love of these delights, they kick and butt at one another with horns and hooves, which are made of iron. They kill one another by reason of their insatiable lust. And there are many places where Plato talks about things like this, that this is the irrational world of the senses, of individual objects that we see in front of us. We could start off with the Phaedo, or the Phaedo, one of the greatest of the Platonic dialogues, a few hundred years before Christ. And this recounts the last few hours of Socrates' life, Plato's teacher, and he was slated for execution. So clearly, the soul and its immortality is coming up for discussion. And ultimately, Plato argues the soul should be the main focus of our lives, and the only real way to care for it is to strive for understanding, truth with a capital T. Of all true things, true statements we come across on a regular basis, what do they all have in common? So you have a clear contrast between unchanging forms and then the flux and the chaos of the material particulars within which we live. So a particular refers to individual objects, ordinary material things taken as a singular thing, a tree, a cat, an act of love, an act of justice. They're all examples of a sensible or a particular. A sensible, though, a particular, is also a thing that has the properties or qualities that are predicated from something else, and not of itself a predicate. Of course, that something is a form. Again, we spell it with a capital F. Now, one error of Plato, which you see in the Phaedo, is that his emphasis was on the soul striving for freedom from the body. Plato rejected the concept of matter, that it's the realm of unknowing, a particular and material prison that always gets in the way of approaching truth. It isn't flesh or matter that's the problem, it's in its fallen state. Flesh has many meanings, and it's not merely the body. However, Christ taking flesh, Logos taking flesh, nullified the argument. Logos, in fact, is the receptacle of all the forms taken together, which was unthinkable in Plato's time. Plato would even go so far as to say that senses aren't capable of even helping us reach the truth, since they are unclear, and since they're only, by their very nature, attached to sensible things, they can't help us at all. So Plato says a soul alone can reach truth without contact with the body, or despite such contact. And the Phaedo, Socrates says that, can we say that justice itself is something? Then have you seen any of these sorts of things with your eyes? In no way. But then have you grasped them with any other sense through your body? I am talking about all of these, for instance, about size, health, strength. In a word, about the essence of all of them. Whoever of us should prepare himself to consider most accurately each thing itself about which he inquires, that one would come closest to knowing each thing. He would do so most clearly, using his intellect itself by itself. And that's one of the first areas where Plato's doctrine of the forms is outlined. He's talking about not acts of justice, but justice itself, what they all have in common. A form, first and foremost, it is an existing entity, existing in virtue of themselves, not from another. That's something called self-predication. Now, of course, the form is, not in Plato, but in Christianity, in St. Augustine and others, Maximus the Confessor, the form exists in virtue of Logos. Logos is the second person of the Trinity. And yet the principle is the same. A form of something is what a particular aspect of it is meant to be but can never be. The form is the final purpose of particulars, as Aristotle would say later. They're simple. They don't have any parts. But as we've already said, particular things have parts and they're complex, and hence they're capable of falling apart. A form cannot be divided, but a particular can be. Forms are what remains when a singular object comes to be and then passes away. It's what survives change. Human nature remains the same as a man is born, grows, and dies. So a form is that which remains the same when everything else around it changes. Well, Plato says in the same place, he says, for it seems to me that if anything else is beautiful besides beauty itself, it is beautiful on account of nothing else than because it partakes of beauty itself. And I speak in the same way about everything else. And what he means everything else is things like justice and goodness and love, as well as mathematical chemical entities. So, but what he says in this passage, we're talking about two things. The being of a form, and what it means to participate in it. Participation is a technical term. Being simply is. It's the essence of a form. And participation means to be in regard to something else. The connection between a form and the material chaotic world that we live in is, of course, the most difficult and controversial of all philosophical doctrines. They have to be connected in some way, though. We do see individual things, however imperfectly, from its ideal form, but they have to be connected. You have the form itself and that which is spoken through the form, the specific examples of it. There are forms for every property involved in the myriad changes affecting material objects, you know, birth, growth, all this stuff. So a woman could be called beautiful, but we all know she can't be beautiful for long. She went from one to the other, and as she ages, she'll go back again. So beauty as a form has to exist, because it comes and goes in this particular woman. In other words, a beautiful woman participates in beauty for a time, and that's the relation between a particular woman and beauty. As the former gets old and dies, but the form does not. Beauty as a form, by the way, and whether or not the form is itself beautiful is misconstruing the issue, but certainly is not in a way an individual specific woman might be beautiful. Beauty as a form is beautiful without qualification, but of course a beautiful woman is qualified, and there's no real logical reason why a woman should be beautiful. It's only empirically the case. It's accidentally the case. Participating in beauty is what makes a woman beautiful. Being, in this case, is just a formal quality, only imperfectly and temporarily manifests in a particular woman. But beauty, with a capital B, predates her existence and remains, of course, long after she's gone. So the subject is particular, what we're observing in front of us, and the predicate is the form. This woman in front of me is beautiful. Beauty and that which is beautiful are similar, but they are anything but identical. A particular is a complex, and of course possesses beauty, maybe, to a greater or lesser degree. It's possible that the property of beautiful in form or in a particular manifestation, they differ largely in degree. The form is the perfect and simplest instance of a property in anything that we perceive. So a particular manifesting form is always manifesting it in a highly imperfect and deficient way. It can approximate the nature of a form. So the act of something like beauty being instantiated means that the form is only partly realized. It can never shine through entirely. So of course it follows that the properties that particulars possess will differ from the form of which it partakes. So the form of beauty is always perfect, but a specific woman is imperfectly beautiful. She has a qualified beauty. There are many different types of this qualified beauty, but they still have the beautiful in common. Nothing that we could ever experience has a quality without reservation, regardless of the romantic poets. Now, poetry and the arts in general, as we've talked about on here before, is meant to unmask and to draw out the form hidden in whatever it is that's being depicted. The only true beauty, the only truly beautiful thing is the form itself. Everything else is just partially beautiful, or imperfectly so. Beauty as a form is beautiful to the maximum degree. One of the things that makes it worthwhile is that the form is beautiful and nothing but beautiful. Of course, a beautiful woman is many other things. She could be tall, she could be stupid, she could be white, which in and of themselves don't necessarily relate to beauty as such. So to be beautiful is to have the form in a relatively small and imperfect way. So participation is a matter of identity. To say that beauty itself is beautiful implies the form of beauty is characterized by beauty to a perfect degree. But it wouldn't be beautiful in the sense that it's really not one object among others. It is beyond what a man can perceive or understand. It's the foundation for beautiful things. The form is not necessarily what the form signifies, at least from our point of view as individual men. Beauty is not beautiful in itself, and certainly not beautiful in the same way that it's instantiated in individual beautiful women or beautiful things. There is, however, and there has to be, an ontological relation between form, a subject, and the formal predicate or the essence. There's the form, and we'll get into this, how this fits into the Trinity here in a second. So participation is a relation between material sensibles and their corresponding forms. So the object is defined by the form in which it participates. And of course, there's always going to be more than one. To participate means to take on a specific quality. And everything is characterized by and through the form in which each participates. They're under, so to speak, a specific form. The term for that is hypostasis. There's an essence that links the form itself with its particular, meaning that being is an ontological relation designed to capture that bond between that which possesses an essence and the essence itself possessed. Forms are also said to be unified. They're one. They're one as opposed to several. The only thing that the form of, say, justice could be is just. In the most pure sense, it can't be anything other than justice. Now, we could manifest justice in specific acts or states of affairs, but of course, we're a lot more than just the just acts we may engage in. In the Republic, Plato says that all forms are related to the form of the good, and that each form is itself good, and it fits into the Logos as a divine center of everything. Essence is to form what Logos is to the Father. So each form is what it is in its own right. So in defining what a form is, Plato sometimes talks about it like an individual thing. He's seeking it independently from any of its material manifestations. The good, of course, would be the exception, and that would come the closest to the idea of divinity. Divinity being that which joins the Father and Logos. What each form is in its own right derives from its essence. The connection between the form and the essence, which is predicated of it, is mentioned in the Republic's formula that a given form is what is completely or perfectly. But there has to be an essence because it belongs to the sensible thing predicated by a form, as well as the form itself. In other words, each essence is the essence of exactly one form, and each form has a single essence which defines it. This is extremely important because that essence is very similar, obviously not identical, to the generation of Logos from the Father. It's the content. Logos is a content of the Father projected outward. It is the ultimate source and what that source expresses. Those are two different things. Now, compared to God, it's obviously in a very imperfect way. Forms are created, but Logos is not. A form cannot have an existence separated from its essence like we do. A form exists in its own right. It depends on nothing else for its being. Logos and the Father existed before time began, and the Trinity is self-contained. It is being as such, and it's in regard to nothing else. Of course, creation is just the opposite. It's dependent and contingent on the forms found in Logos in creation. Each form exists, even if there are no corresponding particulars. So, for example, justice will still exist even if there's not a single just act to be found in a particular society. Eric Vogelin said that to the extent that such acts, either acts of love or acts of justice, as that gets fewer and fewer, the form of justice or the good gets more and more distant and more abstracted from the society. Its essence is predicated of the form independently of our knowledge or its relation to anything else. It exists per se in its own right, as only God can do, or Logos in this case. Logos is the essence of God the Father. On the other hand, mankind, we are both existence and essence, and they're never lined up entirely. We always fall short, like any particular thing, of our mission and purpose. So there's little that's more controversial than Plato's doctrine of the forms. It's one of the greatest intellectual revolutions in world history. A form is that which is pursued when we try to find out what something is. The form of justice, for example, is what it's just, is something that's just by its very nature. You see in the Republic. A line, you know, there's two different conceptions of a line. You could draw a line on a piece of paper, but that's not what a mathematician thinks a line is. In fact, the mathematician uses the conception of a line that can't be manifest physically. The line drawn on paper is not what geometry means by a line. It's only a very rough approximation of it. Same thing goes for numbers to be found in the natural world. Justice exists in a form maybe that's consistent with certain institutions and acts, and justice as such, though, is the measuring rod for just acts and just states. When you take even the most beautiful conception of natural law, the minute you try to make that, to instantiate that in a particular society, it's going to be messy. Because existence and essence are two separate things. So I mentioned the Phaedo only because it has the most complete understanding of what a form is. A form is unchangeable. It is eternal. It is intelligible in that it can only be seen by reason. It's not perceptible, has nothing to do with the senses. It's divine, in Plato's sense of the term. It's incorporeal. It actually causes and is a foundation for everything else. It is unqualified. And of course, what the instances of this thing exist only with qualification, and they're uniform and pure in and of themselves. In the Timaeus, which is a separate dialogue, the chief star of that story makes a distinction between what always is and never becomes versus what becomes and never is. A form is what always is and never becomes. And that could be understood only by reason. It's in the noumenal realm. What becomes and never is, that's a simple matter of opinion. That's pure phenomenon. And it involves at least some measure of sense perception, conformity, and irrationality or sub-rationality. Something else that Plato talks about in this dialogue is the demiurgos, or the demiurges. While Christianity rejects it entirely, it is one of the core principles of the occult, of the arcana. The demiurge is a very powerful being that creates the universe, although not from nothing. The demiurge uses the forms as a model to build the universe. He constructs the universe. And it's in the same way that the forms are models for the philosopher ruler to imitate in building the state. Now, in Timaeus, forms are mentioned. It's in the context of the distinction between understanding or knowledge on the one hand and a truthful opinion, or just an opinion, on the other. A truthful opinion is, of course, truthful. It's correct, but it only comes from, you know, memorization. It comes from a proper education, not critical thinking. So the idea of, in the Timaeus, those things which always are and never become, that's being as such. That's the world of the forms or logos. That's the framework of Plato's cosmology. So the universe has to be a product of the demiurge or the craftsman imitating something. It has to be the imitation of the forms. Remember, Plato is proceeding from pure reason. So let me put it like this. And this has been in a few papers, so it's not original to me by any means. Some things are, And they always are, without ever becoming. That could only be logos. That can only be the realm of the Trinity. Opinion refers to those things that are always in the process of becoming without ever actually being. If something is, always is, then it can only be approached by understanding, that is to say, reason, knowledge. If it's becoming, if it's something that comes to being, into being and passes away, it is a matter of the senses, opinion, not reason. If it's true, it's true only accidentally. Now, Plato says, of course, that the universe is a thing that has been brought into being. It's been created. And that it's visible, it's tangible. And if it's visible and tangible, then it has to be perceptible. The very fact that we can perceive it means that it comes into being at some point. But what does that mean? Anything that is brought into being has to be caused. It has to be brought into being by something greater than itself. The universe, therefore, has to be caused by something since it came into being. And that's where the doctrine of the Demiurgos comes from. And he fashions all of this in using the forms as a model. Now, the model itself is something that always is. This is Logos. This is God himself. This is extremely important. Now, the Demiurge is supremely good, as Plato says, but that doesn't mean he is perfect. He does, however, and is the first to state that the universe has been fashioned from logos, that is to say, the forms taken together. Now, let me go back to the statement that if something becomes, comes to being and passes away, it is grasped by opinion and not reason. It's true only accidentally. And that refers to a particular thing possessing something not connected with a form. It's the imperfection. Now, the Demiurge, of course, is far from perfect, and creation is anything but, even at its origin. It's not copying things by replicating logos, since it always existed. It's taking logos and translating it into a material, tangible, you know, three-dimensional universe. And that's what's called the receptacle of all becoming or space. So this is only an imitation of the forms. However, the model is eternal. The model, of course, is not tangible, is not material, and is not three-dimensional. It's sort of like a builder with, you know, a schematics in front of him. So the intelligible and non-material is what provides the, or prescribes the features of whatever it is to be built. So forms cannot possess that which only visible, tangible things can possess. So considering forms like a set of schematics makes a lot of sense. Now, Plato didn't have precisely the doctrine of the fall of man, although he certainly was exposed to the idea of the Golden Age and to a great extent accepted it. The problem is the Golden Age possessed the tools of its own denigration. Well, there was nothing in the Garden of Eden that necessarily would lead to sin and the destruction of innocence. The doctrine of the fall, the Demiurge didn't necessarily need to be below God, but he could be God himself, in a sense. However, the occult deals with the Demiurge as the imperfect builder of the universe, and the significance here is that it's the foundation of the Tikkun Olam. It empowers, in this case, the Jews to perfect what the Demiurge first built, and to correct what this being has initially assembled. In fact, in the Republic, Socrates argues that once the Golden Age is gone, mankind then seeks to fulfill its passions. It's very much like the fall of man. And only then can we really worry about the forms or the virtues? Because now they have to be understood rationally rather than intuitively. So the ideal city that we're talking about in terms of natural law, that only can be understood when our innocence has been lost. The greatest of sins, in fact, maybe the very definition of sin. So in dialogues like the Timaeus, we're talking about the distinction between the physical and the eternal world, the noumenal versus the phenomenal world. So the physical world is where you have changes, things come to be and pass away. It's chaotic, it's phenomenal. That's the realm of opinion, irrational sensation, passion. The noumenal realm, the eternal realm, never changes, and therefore can be the only place where knowledge is able to be found. Two worlds, the noumenal and the phenomenal, they're conditioned by the objects that you find within them. The changeless world, the spiritual realm, is fixed and eternal. The phenomenal realm of change only deals with probabilities, not absolute certainty. So as being is to becoming, so truth is to belief. So he even says in the description, and say the physical world, the realm of science, the closest you can get is a likely story. Of course, in the realm of change, nothing changes without a cause. And hence, we're back to the Demiurge again. The Timaeus refers to him as the father and maker of the universe. But obviously, he doesn't create out of nothing, since the forms predate him, as does matter, by the way. Now, prior to that, it existed purely in the realm of flux. In other words, it didn't really exist at all. Matter existed, but it had no qualities. The Demiurge in Plato was good, but imperfect. He did want as much good as possible in his creation, but the translation from the ideal world to our world is very difficult. It's like taking an ideal such as, say, equality, or aristocracy, and actually imposing it on a functional society, making it an institution. That very descent is just that. It's a descent. You're bringing it into the realm of chaos and change. It's only going to be imperfectly manifest. That's the nature of reality. Therefore, you know, a utopian project, that doesn't make any sense. And the Timaeus, the chaos is the lack of balance. You know, Plato believed in the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. But of course, order is better than chaos. And so the Demiurge was able to bring order and clarity to the flux. Now, of course, Justin Martyr rejected the concept of the Demiurge, but not the mentality that served as its foundation. We can say that the world was as perfect as it could be in its creation, but then with the fall of man, that spread to everything. So it became imperfect. In Plato's case, the Demiurge was imperfect. So it was imperfect from the very beginning. So one of the things that the Demiurge was concerned with was balance, and balancing among the four elements. Fire and earth are the foundational ones because they make bodies visible as solids. But fire and earth have to be unified. Any two things have to have a third to unify them. Two things cannot be rightly put together without a third. There must be some bond of union between them, as Plato says there. Since the world is not a surface, but it's three-dimensional, you therefore needed a fourth thing to reach harmony, and that was the realm of water and air. And he gets involved in physics, the nature of the circular movement, which Plato says is the most appropriate to mind and intelligence, because it's strictly uniform. And then more abstract forms such as sameness, difference, and being, that which is indivisible and another that's divisible. So mixed beings, sameness and difference. These are varieties of form. Now the difference, the concept of sameness and difference is genre and species. So color is a form within which you find red. Red is a form within which you find something like pink or crimson. And you can go higher in generality or lower in generality. One of the metaphors that Plato uses, connecting particulars to the forms, is one of the most important, is the idea of a model and its copy. So the physical world, we live in the phenomenal world, it's a copy or an image of the forms. And of course, all copies are dependent on their originals. So the physical world that's described in the Timaeus is dependent on these forms, put together by an imperfect but good craftsman. Now, of course, Christians reject that, but that's possible. God did not create an imperfect world. God created a world that an innocent couple was put in, and they fell, introducing division and separation, reason rather than intuition. So in the Phaedo, you're talking about qualities that differentiate particulars from forms. Again, forms are immaterial, they're non-spatial, they're outside of time, but particulars are the opposite. Forms don't change, but particulars do. Particulars are complex, forms are pure, simple, and uniform. Now here's what Aristotle had to say about this in his Metaphysics. He says, Socrates sought the universal in them in turn to definitions. Plato, accepting this, thought that this defining comes to be about different things and not about sensible things. For it is impossible that the common definition be about any of the sensibles, for these are always changing. So a limited conception of the form would be a definition. It has boundaries that it cannot cross and remain the same thing. But if you want to talk about knowledge and truth, it can't be changing. Truth by its very definition doesn't change. Therefore, it can't be a function of our phenomenal realm. Truth, therefore, is our grasping, reaching for the form as it's instantiated in our imperfect universe. So the search for knowledge leads to these definitions. You know, the opposite of a definition is a spectrum. A spectrum is cheating. But a definition creates boundaries. Now, Plato never really told us where these forms are located, but Christianity solved the problem. Not only were they found in Christ as the second person of the Trinity, if you remember last week, the forms are found in the divine nature of the Chalcedonian formula. They are joined with the human nature. This is how the realm of the forms was brought down to the simplest of people through this union of the two natures. Particular things are deficient because they change. And they change because their properties are contingent. They're not necessary. The form of justice is necessarily justice, has to be just. Our just acts are contingent. They're contingent on many things. They're also cognitively deficient because they're complex. So the factor responsible for an object being deficient in connection with the form is that their properties are only contingently related to them. In forms, properties are necessary. We can perceive a just act. It to some extent perceives injustice, but there's so much about it that we simply don't know. It's contingent on many things, including motivation, in fact, especially motivation. Particular things are almost rejected as useless by Socrates and Plato. They're branded as a material object, and they're spoken strictly in a negative way. So Plato stresses, if not overstresses, that the main feature that characterizes a particular object that we may come across is the fact that it's material. It's extended in space and time. That automatically means that it's composite or complex. It's subject to change precisely because it has parts. If something doesn't have parts, it can't fall apart. You have a concept of the compresence of opposites, which is a term where, in Plato's sense, you can approach perception that has as a necessary component the interaction of material elements. There's qualifications that have to account for a particular object's existence, it being one thing and not another. Comparing it to other extended objects, and in different relations to us as knowers. You could have more than one form instantiated in one object, which of course is impossible for the forms. So because the sensible is material, it's mutable, it's subject to death, destruction, birth. To be material is to appear. It's to appear in a very specific way. Now, there's two kinds of properties here. There is a properties that are determinate, like crimson and scarlet, they come under red, for example, as I mentioned already. But determinants are quantitative. You ask how long is a stick, you give a very specific answer in centimeters or something. Properties at one point are generic, but then when they are actually manifest in an object, they take on a very specific determinate character. As I mentioned, a triangle, you have a three-sided figure in the formal ideal form, has lines that have no physical existence, and whose angles have no determinate degree. But of course, there's any particular triangle that we come across will have both of those things. The lines will have a certain width, and angles will have specific degrees. Quality becomes quantity as it gets instantiated. A form of a triangle is abstract and has no specific dimensions. It's not inherently possessed of, say, a 40-degree angle somewhere. But when it's instantiated in particular, it has to be specific and determinate. In fact, it's always specific, like length, color, size, whatever else, because the particular is concrete. And because the property, what we're talking about in the particular, is itself an instance of a non-determinate property. Form is non-determinate. The manifestation is determinate. It's a downgrade from the form. It's the reign of quantity, where everything then is reduced to individual objects, which is the whole problem with nominalism to begin with. Platonic realism, is a reference to the forms, is of course the opposite of nominalism. You know, what right triangle does the Pythagorean formula fit? I know this is a common, you know, everyone who took a philosophy course understands this. No triangle can match the exactitude that's implied in a squared plus b squared equals c squared. I don't care how carefully a triangle is constructed, it's going to be imperfect. The very fact that you have to draw lines automatically means it's imperfect. A line, by definition, like a point, doesn't have a physical manifestation. Physical manifestations are really symbols in this case. So if there are no perfect right triangles in the world, then what's the Pythagorean theorem? I mean, it has to be true, right? So it has to be about something. It has to be about something that exists in the realm of forms. It has to. But when we talk about justice, goodness, or anything like this, again, there are two realms. There are two ways of being. That is, being itself on the one hand and participation on the other. Objects are distinguished based on their respective ways of being. A sensible thing is deficient. It's not perfect because its properties derive from the form, which is appropriate to it, never in a perfect manner. existence and essence are never totally matched together. By the way, those imperfections are, this is really what we mean by sin. And not even necessarily, it's in an ontological, not a moral category. So going back to the beauty example, the beauty of a woman is not itself deficient. It's how the woman possesses it. Really, only forms are definable. So as far as participation is concerned, each form that exists in the numeral realm has an essence. If an object, anything we come across, is predicated to a form, a just act is predicated to justice, then the particular act has that quality. So the particular act of justice is what it is in virtue of the form of justice being what it is. So if a particular has a certain form, say a beautiful woman or a just act, then it has to, in some sense, contain the form. Beauty alone is beautiful, beautiful without qualification. If the form and its essence are identical or close to identical, the essence must also be predicated of particulars. Now, the Republic is the longest, most elaborate defense of his central doctrines, including the forms. Most people come to understand the forms through the Republic. And of course, every one of the Platonic dialogues is about a form. Virtue, piety, bravery, the military arts, justice, the Republic's about justice, knowledge, existence. But things like justice and the good are different ontologically from the rest of the forms that we've talked about. Nowhere does Plato give a full list. And I think that's largely impossible, which is why I wrote my paper on the social nature of the forms, which I dealt with elsewhere. But the Republic says the best life is one devoted to virtue and knowledge. And that life will result in happiness, which is itself the result of justice, or the nature of a just order. The soul has three parts in Plato's world, and this was taken by Christians later on. Reason, or nous, that's what can approach the form of the good in other forms. At the highest, the lowest is passion, the drives, and in the middle is the very controversial spirited or motivating part. It's the fervor that comes from knowing that you're right. It's not a drive per se, because it's conditioned by the truth. It's not a virtue per se, although it might be connected to them in terms of a motivating factor. Now, all three of those parts have to all be doing their job properly, creating a harmonious unit under the rational that is a formal element. So reason, appetite, and the spirit, motivation, govern all of his our pursuits as a singular thing. That alone creates not just justice, but happiness. Now, the soul has three parts. So does the state. The three parts, of course, many of you know, the philosopher rulers, very small and sequestered group, the guardians or the warriors, and of course, everyone else, the laborers, those making money, those in what Hegel would call civil society. And they have to work in harmony with one another under the auspices of the ruler who has to be embodied reason. So in the Republic, he contrasts the philosopher rulers, which again is very contentious, even in Plato's own work, contrast those with the lovers of spectacle, sight lovers, he calls them, those people who are easily influenced, they're lured by their fantasies. The philosopher who pursues the world of the forms, logos, has true knowledge. He doesn't even have beliefs at that point, he has knowledge. But the lover of the spectacle, that's nominalism. That's the person who denies that there is such a thing as beauty itself. but believe stupid things like beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and there are as many different beautiful things as there are people and perceptions of it. By virtue of that, he completely lacks knowledge, and the only thing he possesses is opinion. Opinion in Plato might be correct, but there's nothing about it that has to be inherently correct. It may be correct by accident. People who stumble upon a truth without really knowing its origin. That's what opinion is, and it's always changing. It's conditioned by time and place, fashion, power, whatever. That's why the forms are important. Socrates is distinguishing the mental states along with the objects to which they aim. So that which completely is, and always has been, is the foundation of knowledge. Ignorance, of course, is set over things that are not. That is to say, ignorance is based on the belief that something is real that is in fact not real. In between those two extremes is opinion. It's set over what is and is not at the same time. That's the imperfect world that we live in every day. The forms on the one extreme are pure being, and the flux is pure becoming. But those are extremes. Most of what we, if not all, the things that we deal with are in the middle. So the objects that each layer deals with and what they do with those objects is their final purpose. Which is another way of saying that there's a huge gulf between the true and something being true. True or false as opinion is, since there's always a small kernel of truth, even in the most absurd falsehoods. So knowledge is always true, whereas belief and opinion are really a mixed bag. They may be true or partly true, and if it's totally true, it's totally true by accident. Knowledge is set over with a proper understanding of what exists and what does not exist. Opinion is the pieces of truth that don't grasp the whole. But what exists without qualification is logos, which contains the forms. And that's why the two worlds, and that's where the two worlds come from. The objects of belief, the objects of opinion, and that of knowledge are very distinct. Opinion, that big middle ground, is concerned with particulars, has to be, and passions. They're not systemic. But on the other hand, forms are systemic. They provide knowledge. And they are the supreme realities. We're going to end here, the end of 6 and 7 of the Republic, the sun, the divided line in the cave. Many of you have come across this. But you can't understand the forms and ultimate reality, and hence Platonic realism, without them. The sun is a common metaphor, not just in Plato, but exists throughout the ancient world. It's to, and the point of these is to contrast the visible and intelligible realm together, the phenomenal or noumenal, that which is changing versus that which does not change. The phenomenal realm is different from the eternal realm, and that eternal realm, the truth, is generated and governed by the sun. It provides the light needed to see things for what they are. So it really is a phenomenal matter, but a true understanding of the phenomenal world. That's what why the sun is so important. Corresponding to the sun in the intelligible realm is the good, or logos. The sun is a symbol, not the reality. The sun illumines the physical world. Goodness as a form, the form of the good, is logos, is God himself. And, of course, is responsible for the existence of anything that is knowable, and reality itself. And this is connected with the divided line. There's a division in the world, dividing the cosmos into two sections. The phenomenal world, of course. At the very bottom, you could find images, shadows, and deception. The realm of opinion, of the politician, of the lawyer, of the sophist. Ordinary physical objects which if their images are copies, is the upper portion, and set over those images is imagination or fantasy. In the physical world, it's belief or conviction, as opposed to the truth as a logical matter. So you have the intelligible and the phenomenal elements, still the two worlds' ideas. Of course, the highest is comprised of the forms. The faculty that's set over them, of course, is nous, knowledge, understanding, even beyond reason. The good itself is part of this. It's the location of the rest. Now, of course, we understand it as logos. There is a third section of the line, the anoia, the cognitive capacity for, or even the result of discursive thinking, post-lapsarian thought, mathematics, any technical science. It's not immediate, it's mediate. It uses concepts rather than intuitive apprehension. The objects are an abstract of ordinary material things, but they're not unreal, like deceptive shadows or moonlight. Moon and sun are opposed. Moonlight creates distortion. Sunlight illumines everything. So all of these so far are connected with the two worlds. The cave, I think, is the best known of them all. It's meant to reinforce everything that we've already talked about. Most of you know the story. Picture an underground cavern where seated prisoners are chained so they can't move their heads, like in Clockwork Orange, and they're forced, therefore, to stare at a cave wall upon which others, and they're very shadowy others, project images. There's a fire behind the prisoners, and it's in front of that that they cast shadows. Shadows are actually lower than images, and these images are cast from carved figures. They're illumined by a fire, and they're carried by a shadowy group of people on a parapet behind them. Once in a while, a prisoner can escape. And when that happens, he leaves the cave and goes into the real world of being. And the first thing that happens is that he's blinded by the sun. He really can't understand it. He can't see everything around him. He eventually becomes acclimated to it. Initially, he can see the shadows and reflections in the water, for example, the images that are cast by actual real things. But then as he gets acclimated, he can perceive with great clarity and eventually comes to understand the source of the illumination or the sun itself. Life in the cave is an entirely administered one. It's what is perceived is taken to be real, sanctioned by the opinion leaders of the day, fashionable ideology. As Leo Strauss would call them, fabricated conventional opinions. That's the world, that's life in a cave. It's life in the postmodern world. Because as Alexander Dugin says, the postmodern world differs from the modern one in this way. So the Platonic realism that we're talking about forms the immaterial world that informs the material world is on top, of course. This divided line suggests. Then you have actual individual objects, individual things, examples, you know, acts of love, acts of justice, objects that we come across, trees and cats and everything else. But that's strictly the modern world based on nominalism. The postmodern doesn't even have the objects. The only thing that's left is images and words. So this is beyond the Enlightenment. The postmodern means that even the individual object doesn't exist anymore. You know, we started this talk, me talking about how the individual object is a myth. It falls apart, as Hegel would say, upon perception. It's not one object. It's God knows how many individual things, like the DNA in its relationship to human nature. It's a huge a complex of factors, not this singular individual object that's sitting in front of me. But the postmodern of course, accepts that and then says that nothing exists except the will to power, that is to say, images or fantasies that you can broadcast on a screen, and words. Words stand in fact, substitute for reality, and as definitions slowly change, therefore reality changes. Well, who has the power to control the definitions of words? So, the forms, they exist because there really is no proof of the reality of our sense data, anything that we perceive. Therefore, truth has to exist outside of the sense impressions of this so-called outside world. It's a difference between a right triangle and the concept of a right triangle. They are different from each other. They can never fully overlap. Therefore, the forms have to be spiritual in nature. They have to exist outside of space and time. What is real is energy, but energy itself, to the extent that it makes up our inner states, that has to be reduced to their foundations. Ultimately, it comes down to that which cannot be seen, or the forms, the elemental outlines of all that is. That which is behind the flux of the objects that we come across every day. The foundations of creation and its origin and its purpose. Since the sense data that we are surrounded with is varied and is always changing, to make any knowledge claim, you have to hang that somewhere. And it has to hang in some place that is immaterial and eternal. That's the very nature of truth. So in the postmodern world, we are two steps away from reality. We exist entirely in a world of images, fantasies, images of images, and constantly changing word definitions depending on what the powerful need. So it's not the scientific truth anymore. It's just science as a word. It's not believe in the objects of science, but believe in science with a capital S. They're not talking about forms. They're talking about a power relationship. So we are living two steps removed. In other words, the average American lives in a fantasy world that he does not understand. He cannot think systematically. The forms are, to the extent that they're exposed to it at all, are either misdefined, undefined, totally misunderstood. You know, psychology, every once in sociology tries to deal with this stuff every once in a while, and they butcher it. So people think that they know, and in fact, they don't. And to the extent that the forms are banished, the form of justice and love and human nature, whatever, of course, modernity and postmodernity reject the very concept of human nature or nature in general, like we talked about with Chalcedon. There are no boundaries. Everything is a matter of negotiation, and hence everything is a matter of power. To the extent that these forms go away, those who understand the truth become that much more marginal. And that's where we find ourselves today. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.